Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Movie Breakdown. This is one that we've been excited about for a while, as we're going to be talking about Todd Phillips' DC film called The Joker, and as well, Zach Galifianakis bringing us Between Two Ferns, the movie. And then as well, the internet went crazy this week because Martin Scorsese had some comments about basically superhero films in general and about not watching them. And we're going to discuss, maybe was he right, was he wrong, or what do we think and what do other people think? Anyways, thank you for joining us for this wonderful episode. I'm Scott Martin.
And I am Christopher Spicer. And before we get into the reviews, there's just a quick little thing I want to say here. I don't want to dig too deep because I don't know how much Scott wants to reveal, so I don't want to blindside him, but I just want to publicly say that Scott had a big sort of challenge coming to him this week, something that he was nervous about and something that I don't think he would have been able to accomplish 2 years ago, yet here he is. He did it like a champ, and I just want to say, Scott, this is awesome. I'm proud of you. And I know I'm being vague, but it's because I don't know what you want to reveal to people. But people, I think they know you have emotional issues. You had a big challenge this week that I don't even know if you could have done a year ago. You did it. Be proud of yourself.
Thanks, Chris. I do appreciate that. And I'm fine with it staying vague. And I just, there was some good people that definitely rooted me on. So.
Well, that's all people need to know. You had a challenge this week, and you accomplished it like a champ. That's all I wanted to say. That's all our listeners need to know.
Perfect. Perfecto. Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Speaking of mental illness, we're going to do the movie The Joker. I sang it.
You did sang it real well, I think. I haven't seen it.
Except it's not called The Joker. Sorry, it's called Joker. I just pulled a grandma. Did you go see The Joker?
Here's a movie ticket to go see a Joker.
So anyways, here we are. We're doing Todd Phillips directed Joaquin Phoenix starring Joker. And Todd Phillips didn't hide the fact that him and the screenwriter Scott Silver, a pretty accomplished screenwriter, was very inspired by Martin Scorsese movies. Hey, that's another link to this week's show.
There we go.
And more specifically, be inspired to stuff like Taxi Driver and definitely kind of comedy, to the point where I would say this movie is very much kind of a copy of the kind of comedy and that film. It's sort of this idea of being a bit of a character study, a character piece on someone who is very disturbed, someone who you could say, has some psychotic tendencies, homicidal, very violent, very dangerous, very similar to those two movies. But also, I would say it rings some similarities to something like Harry, A Portrait of a Serial Killer, which was a movie obviously about a serial killer, Michael Rooker's big performance that kind of was his breakout. And it even reminded me a bit of Dog Day Afternoon, sort of exploring that idea of how villains, criminals can become almost heroes and a city can come behind them. And so it has all that stuff. What I would say, though, is this is a bold direction for a comic book movie. And I definitely will give Todd Phillips props and DC props for going in that direction for this very dark movie set on a very iconic comic book character, the Joker. We wouldn't expect something this gritty, and so I'd give it props for that. But I really wonder how fascinated people would be to this movie if it wasn't about an iconic comic book character. If this was just about a character called Arthur Fleck and he never becomes a Joker, I feel like this doesn't stand even close to stuff like Taxi Driver or kind of comedy, those things that I mentioned. I feel like it just kind of follows those beats. It's a film to me that feels very kind of episodic and very out to shock you. It's incredibly violent and there's some incredibly grotesque scenes and there's definitely that type of stuff. But I go walking away from it saying, to what point though? There's no character arc here and it has all this violence and it talks about the rottenness of the city. and these foul characters, but what was it actually telling me? What was it telling me about violence? And I feel like, again, like it's hard to compare it to Taxi Driver, which is a classic, but those films are saying something and they have levels here. And I just feel this was just kind of, I think it thought it was really smart, and I think it thought it was trying to say something, be deep, but in the end it came out saying, I don't think it brought anything new other than, let's make one of these kind of movies with an iconic comic book character. What we have here is Arthur Fleck is he's working at a place where they basically rent out clowns. You could be a clown for parties or for ads or hold a sign dressed as a clown type thing. That's sort of what he does. Very quickly on, he gets beat up for being a clown. Someone steals his sign and beats him down. And so we get this idea that he gets picked on a lot. He gets abused a lot. And we just see the nastiness of the city. And he gets beaten. But then we also learn that he's had some time in a mental institution. We find out he's got these dark thoughts. He's delusional. And I think the film sort of doesn't really want you to think, like, oh, the beating down is what's led to this. You're not supposed to empathize with him. So in some ways, I was just wondering, I didn't really understand the two points other than just making the movie continuously dark and gritty and vague in those ways, as he encounters a lot of people who are mostly nasty. He cares for his mom at home. He looks after her. She's also mentally disturbed, and he's just really thin and malnourished looking. And I definitely would say that Joaquin Phoenix put himself through the grinder to take on this role. You can see why he says he doesn't want to return to it, as he's lost tons of weight and he really does look like someone who's hit on some hard times. And I think Joaquin Phoenix's performance is really good for what he's expected to do here, even though I didn't think the narrative itself was interesting, but he throws himself in. It's a powerhouse performance. Like, you're always going to expect something from him. Arthur Fleck wants to become a stand-up comedian. And even though, like, his mom even asked him, why, you're not, don't you need to be funny to be a comedian? The idea is he doesn't really have any jokes. And so you're not really sure why he wants to do that. That's what he's decided that he's focused on, obsessed with, and his goal is to eventually become a guest on the Murray Franklin show. Murray Franklin is played by Robert De Niro. This is stunt casting, but I thought it was kind of smart because obviously Robert De Niro is known for being Taxi Driver. He's known for being the psycho in the King of Comedy. So it's sort of cool to see him do that reverse. Unfortunately, Robert De Niro is kind of phoning it in, and his character, along with a lot of things, I never quite understood the motivation. I think Todd Phillips does some really good directing here, and it's stylized. I think sometimes he tries to be too cute in sort of this idea of sometimes perception versus reality, because I felt it left me at a distance, and I couldn't connect with anything that was happening because I was wondering, is this the perception of the character, or is this what's actually happening here? And I thought sometimes he didn't necessarily juggle it, especially since some of the characters' motivations, I don't know why they're doing this, so this can't be real, is it? And so there's those aspects. Oh, I should also mention Arthur Fleck's character. He has an illness, I think due to a brain injury he had, where he just starts laughing sometimes randomly. Like, he's uncomfortable, he just starts laughing, he can't control it. And so that's also hints of what he's going to become as the Joker. And I guess as an origin story, some people will be interested in that type of stuff. But like I said, in the end, I didn't really see it as an arc per se. I didn't really feel like I learned much more of the Joker. There's definitely some fan service here. The people I'm with liked it a lot more than me, and there's definite fan service to the Batman mythology, and they dug it, and they're totally into it. To me, it kind of rolled my eyes. I felt it was kind of unnecessary with this movie. It was just there to sort of make the fans happy. Zazie Beetz is in this. I also thought she was really good. She's the kind of love interest for the Arthur Fleck character, and I thought, in the end, I don't really know if that went anywhere, but I thought they played off each other interesting. Like I said, the performances are really strong, and there is a definite style to this film, and so I got to give it props for that aspect. But the actual narrative, I've seen it before. I felt it engaging. I thought it was more just a bunch of episodic stuff rather than a film, and I just thought it was trying too hard to be shocking for no real sake. So I'm only going to give this one 2 stars. Bravo for DC for trying something new, but next time, let's have a good story.
this is always the interesting thing, and I think this is why this type of movie isn't really attempted very often, is because it's hard. Okay,
it's very hard. Taxi Driver is a classic, but how many movies that then follow that mold ended up being good, even?
Yeah, because okay, we're following someone that we shouldn't be rooting for, and the movie should make it clear that, you know, these aren't people we should attach to, but it's got to tell us, we have to be told a reason why we're following them, and we have to learn something, whether it's about society.
And I felt like I got none of those.
Yeah, and because I think about films like Nightcrawler and stuff like that, and, you know, you're with despicable people, but you feel like you're gaining an insight that's valuable. You feel like you're being told something and shown something through this, and I'm really, really disappointed that this film sounds like it falls short of that. And I'd been sort of trying to, you know, put my fingers in my ears and say la 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 la, because started hearing that as more people started seeing it, more critics started seeing it. It seemed to be comments about, you know, there's no real purpose, and I was,
and people could argue with something like Nightcrawler, saying, well, is there a character arc there? And I don't think there was a character arc per se. I think he was who he was, but I really feel like it was saying stuff, and it had engaging characters surrounding him.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like we looked at it and thought, okay, that's clever, because that, you know, is okay. Yeah. What that movie said, maybe it's in its hyperbolic sense, is that how media works? Is that how me as an audience work? So there was a lot to, it felt like there was such a reason for Nightcrawler to exist. It felt like there was purpose to it.
And I would say that even Taxi Driver, as much of a classic as it is, and it is, I would say it's hyperbolic too. I would say most of these movies are probably a bit overblown, but with precision, with a grace, with, like I said, interesting characters. So you're like, okay, this maybe not be full on reality, but I am connected to what I'm seeing here.
Yeah. And let's be honest. I think at the end of Taxi Driver, given a chance to take Candace Bergman on a date again, she probably would have ended up going to the same place.
It's true. He didn't really seem to be connected to reality. And that's the thing. I think Arthur Fleck here, despite Phoenix's great performance, I just think his character is far less interesting than Travis Bickle.
Mm-hmm. Another question for you. This is probably like a geekdom question. Is it Arthur Fleck or is it Jack Napier? Or is it something else?
I believe Jack Napier was created for the Batman movie by Tim Burton. Tim Burton took a lot of pride in saying, I've never read a comic book.
Okay, so, okay, because as a non-comic reader, I didn't know maybe which one would have been more close to real.
Yeah, like for another thing, like the whole idea of Joker killing Batman's parents, I think that was fully introduced by the Tim Burton movie. I don't think that ever existed before.
Okay. Okay.
Just give me a little tidbits of sort of what you've seen as the Joker character. A lot of that, the Joker character from the Burton one is very far removed from most of the Joker in the comic book.
Okay. And far from the Cesar Romero, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I would say they're not necessarily the same. I mean, I guess I quick look at Wiki here, and they're sort of taking Jack Napier as that was one of his. I misread that. I thought I heard alias. No, they're saying alter ego, but yeah, that's largely for just the Batman movie.
Okay, I just needed.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was created. They even said here. Yeah, it was created for the Batman film in 1989. The Jack Napier name.
Okay, that was total geekdom question. Do you think...
Which, you know, I collected Batman comic books, so that's a fine question to ask.
Oh, good, good. And I always liked the name Jack Napier, but Arthur Fleck sounds a lot more normal, which I think is that the... Is sort of what this is going for is much more, like, less extraordinary person?
Yeah, it's trying to be more grounded in reality. It's trying to feel more like I said, that gritty drama thing. I don't really remember any attempts at fantasy in the film. It largely tried to sort of ground in reality, even though, like I said, I didn't necessarily agree with some of the character motivations or how they got in certain directions, but for the most part, it was trying to make it less of your typical superhero movie. This was more realistic, per se.
Mm-hmm. And I just, off of what you said about, Joaquin Phoenix's appearance, because I feel like I can comment on that. It's remarkable, especially since it was like, was it 2 years ago or a year and a half ago or something? I don't know. But you were never really here, and he was very stocky. He was very thick build in that, and like it to the point where I'm thinking about that and seeing what I saw in Joker promotional material and thinking that like, that must have been so unhealthy. That's crazy.
Yeah, no, 100%. He looks very unhealthy here. He's brutally thin, but he's that type of actor. He's that type of actor that does that to his body. He throws himself in a role. I mean, that's why I guess he basically got Todd Phillips to agree that there will be no sequel here.
Okay. And do you think that audiences are going to be walking out, like people who aren't trying to dig into, what does a movie mean? What is it about? But people who are just there for the story. Do you think they're going to walk away with much from the Joker?
Well, here's the interesting thing is I went with three other gentlemen, which I don't do a lot. I go by my own alone quite a bit, but I was able to get their feedback. All three of them liked it more than me. All three had said it was a good movie, but the funny thing is all three of them also said, I didn't really have fun, or I liked it as much as I could with this kind of movie. So they all, I think, almost were hit with a bit of a downer, and they thought it was kind of dark and bleak, but I think they liked the difference of it and it being different. And I'm wondering if that's also coming from a place. Have they seen movies like Harry, A Portrait of a Serial Killer, or King of Comedy, or Taxi Driver? And to them, it's like, oh, this is something different, unique. Because I really think you take away the Joker name, you take away, and it's just a tale. I mean, there's much better ones out there. So I would encourage people to watch an older film rather than watch this. I mean, it's different compared to other mainstream movies today. I mean, the amount of money it's going to make, it's blockbuster level here, so it's different on that aspect. But, I mean, like I said, the three guys I talked to, I think they appreciate it for being something different, and I think they liked a bit of the fan service, like I said, but all three of them kind of almost were like, felt like they were kind of in a downer mood after.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think some of the films that you've mentioned, like Portrait of a Serial Killer, just those are... Those are definitely haunted.
No, those are classics. Like all those movies I mentioned to me are 4-star movies, so maybe I'm being unfair. The problem is, like you kind of said, it's such a hard genre to do. Nightcrawler is another good example. I'm glad you brought that up, a more modern one. But again, both you and I gave it 4 stars. I can't think of anything other than the classics, because when they fail, I just forget them.
Well, that's the thing. This is one of the hardest types of films to pull off.
It's either a masterpiece or crap.
And either you're doing this, which is art, or you're doing theme park rides, and that's a bit of a lead up to the discussion later, but
I liked it though.
Oh, thank you. There's such a good reason why these movies are few and far between, because it's hard to connect with an audience for one, because they're not straightforward tales, but they're so difficult to make, and so difficult to make an audience member feel like they didn't waste their time. Like they weren't just, being brought through awfulness, that they walked out with some sort of insight. And so, when you do a movie like this, you're going to be compared to the very few films out there that have succeeded. It's very hard not to be compared to those.
Yeah. I feel like if you've seen those, I just can't, like I said, I'm coming from a place where I've seen those movies maybe more recently. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing that comparison. And so it might also be my audience. The people I'm with haven't, so they appreciate the differences of it. What I got to warn you though, cause I also felt with the group I was with, no matter what, I think it's going to be a downer movie. Like you have to be aware of that. This is not uplifting. And please, for the love of God, cause I heard that some people did this, do not bring your kids.
Oh,
apparently someone told me they went to a screening and they brought their young kids. I'm like, I get it's in this Batman universe, but no, like, come on, read look at trailers. Come on.
At least it's so easy. The rating system is a letter, and I think we should be able to figure out a simple letter. R equals restricted, or yeah. in Canada it would be 14A.
It was 14A here. Yeah, it didn't make the 18A. It made the 14A, but 14A in Canada is not the same as PG-13.
No.
Marvel movies aren't 14A here. They're PG. So if it's 14A, it's telling you it's pretty intense.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I don't laugh because the kids are exposed to it. I laugh because of what the parents have done. Like, it's just, and it's not a ha-ha laughing at you. I'm just like, it's more of a shake my head. I can't believe this happens.
Yeah, I just don't get it. I mean, I guess they saw Joker and they thought, let's go see it. But you see one commercial and you knew. I mean, Emily saw some commercials and she saw what I was seeing. She's like, oh, that's going to be disturbing. That's not my type of thing. Like, she got that from the commercial. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I took Everett, she would have murdered me.
Yeah, I bet. And Everett wouldn't have slept probably for a week.
Oh, no, this is not a good movie for kids. I mean, I'm fairly kind of open-minded, but I just cannot see. I don't think any kid under, like, 10 at least should be seeing this movie. It's dark, and I don't think they can process it properly because it doesn't have heroes here. It's really dark characters. The material is not good for, I think, a younger brain to process because you may mistaken, because he's here for the whole movie, you may mistaken Joaquin Phoenix as the hero here and start seeing his things as, oh yeah, look what he's doing. Like, he does evil, evil things here. And I don't even think, it's not just even the violence. It's, I'm just scared of how a younger mind would process it.
Yeah. Wow. That's, so don't let your kids watch it. So that's 2 stars for the Joker. And now off to something as intense and vicious. Ha ha.
Well, before you move on, I just quickly want to say, and this is what I thought, but just a confirmation with DC canon, no one knows Joker's actual name in the DC comic books.
Okay. So it's sort of more like the Christopher Nolan. He's there and nobody knows anything about him.
Yeah, all they really know is that he had a wife and kid that was murdered, and that's what set him off in some comic book canon. I think that also gets changed depending who's writing it.
Okay. Now we are off to something very, very different, and this is Zach Galifianakis in Between Two Ferns, the movie, and basically Between Two Ferns is an internet interview show that Zach Galifianakis did with... Well, the interview is happening between two ferns, a fern on one side, a fern on the other. And this is the film version of it. And, you know, there's a history of movies basing themselves off of skits. And I think of the very first one that I was introduced to, Wayne's World. And I look at that, and even with the passage of time and even with how life has evolved and my own maturity and all that, I still look back and I think they nailed it. Because what they did was, what's the essence of the character or the two characters? And we can't have them doing this, the Wayne's World skit the whole time. We have to bring them out of it. And I thought that worked. The next one I saw was actually Bob and Doug McKenzie in... Strange Brew, and once again I found that one worked. And then Saturday Night Live started really spitting out skit movies, and I found out very quickly as a young teen, it's very easy for these movies to not work. It's very easy for these films to just not work, but absolutely suck. And so I had no idea what to expect with Between Two Ferns, the movie, and I still don't kind of know what to expect. Not in necessarily a horrible way. This movie does rely on the concept of the interviews quite a lot. It is Zach Galifianakis doing these interviews with celebrities, and if you haven't seen the YouTube show, he isn't very... He, as as David Letterman said to him, he has no ability for shame or embarrassment. And that sums it up. And so it makes it very awkwardly funny. And basically the concept is Will Ferrell, he's just rolling in money, and he sees a lot of potential for Zach Galifianakis. So he gets his celebrity buddies on the show. And then, and I still don't know why this or how this works, but he's got 20 days to do I can't remember. He's got a certain amount of time to do a certain number of interviews and get to Los Angeles. And it didn't quite make sense to me completely why this had to happen, but it's the plot of the film. So he's going along with his producer, who was, IMDb fooled me. Sorry. Computer issues. His producer, his sound person, and his cameraman. And his cameraman's called Cam, which...
His producer is Carol Hunt.
Yes, and she
was... That's the character's name.
Yes, and the actress was... I thought she was quite funny. I thought she was really good as sort of the doting producer that was just willing to do anything. So we have this plot, and it sort of turns into a road trip movie, and... It, like I said, it relies heavily on the interviews, and by the time it gets to the end, it starts playing more so on movie tropes. But the tropes aren't necessarily super in your face, so if you don't know these things necessarily, you may not catch them as much. Like some movies will have it more so, like you. Even if you don't quite know, you're like, this must be making fun of something. But it's much more subtle than this. And I felt that actually made, because they were trying to be so subtle, it kind of made the last 15, 20 minutes less entertaining. It was sort of slower, and I got what they were trying to do, but it had sort of left behind just that constant awkwardness of Zach Galifianakis, which is, sort of what the movie overplayed on. But I have to say this, if you're going to highlight Zach Galifianakis, this is not a bad vehicle for it. So while I'm saying things that may not be super, super, or sound like super exciting about it, I think that this is how you show him off, because there is some really funny stuff in here, and you have to watch the credits. You have to watch the credits at the end. When you see how some of these actors react to the stuff he says, it is absolutely wonderful. So I'm caught between this, it really isn't doing a great job spoofing things necessarily, but at the same time, I find myself thinking, yes, I like this as a comedy piece for Zach Galifianakis. I think it would be better to look at this as like a special, not as a movie. If this was just like, the 1 hour special of Between Two Ferns, because it doesn't feel cinematic. It doesn't feel a movie. So I am giving it 3 stars because of the laughter I had, but structurally as a film, like I say, it's just not quite there, but we do get some great, great, great cameos. Really wonderful cameos from so many actors. I was going to start naming some, but you really have to go through the entire list, and there are tons of people in here. So 3 stars, but when you hear that, that's based off of the comedy content that I had, not necessarily as a structured film.
Yeah, I'm giving this 3 stars too, much like what you're saying, because I laugh so much. And I knew Between Two Ferns going into this. I watched most of the interviews that he did up on YouTube and on Funny or Die. I saw them before seeing this movie. I mean, I've been watching them for years. I've always found them entertaining. So, I mean, if you like Zach Galifianakis' kind of dry humor and his very inappropriate questions, and you've liked those interviews, I think you'll enjoy this movie, because the movie has a whole slew of brand new interviews in the throughout it.
And some of the stuff is so degrading to the people he's interviewing. Like,
So it's a certain type of humor too. Like I don't know if my wife would necessarily even find this stuff funny. I found it hilarious. I thought all the interviews are really good. Like you, it's a challenge turning a skit into a movie. Turning something that's funny for 3 minutes and trying to make it into a feature-length movie is really hard. I could be wrong, but I think the first one that had ever been done was the Blues Brothers. Or that's the first one that the first really well-known one, as that became a big hit. And then I think Strange Brew would have been shortly after that. And then you have Wayne's World. And I mean, I know there's others, and I could list them if you wanted, but I would say those are the only three that really worked, the Wayne's World sequel, but those are the only ones that really work as movies. And I would say this one's a bit of a step down, but it's given 3 stars because it maintained the last for the most part. Mm-hmm. I do, like you, wonder if this would have worked maybe better at 40 minutes than an hour and a half.
Yeah, because it sort of got that feel, right? It's got that, it doesn't feel like a movie. It should be just a special. Oh, I just saw John.
Well, because the narrative stuff doesn't really work. You're right. Like, yeah. I don't really know why he has to do this other than they're like, well, obviously Between Two Ferns needs to have interviews. So how do we have a story that justifies him keep on having interviews? So let's do that. And so there's that. I also... was I supposed to take this as a mockumentary, or that just happens at certain parts in the movie?
Yeah.
The mockumentary part just kind of falls apart.
It's just certain parts of the movie, yeah. So that was a bit confusing as well.
Yeah, I ended the movie confused, because it also it bookends it. So just like, wait, was this whole thing a mockumentary? But I guess not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's little things like that. But, yeah, like I said, but, I mean, I think Zach Galifianakis, like you said, is really showcased here. I think he's really good here. I really love the end credit stuff. Stick around, because that's the first time you sort of see the human side to Zach's character. You get to see he did play Persona here. Like, I like when he sort of reveals himself a bit with some of, I guess you could call the bloopers or the gags. I really like that part. I think it's a really important compliment to the film.
Oh, it is, because it's so well done. The interviews are so well done that you may actually think, I think those celebrities are really pissed off at him. Like, it almost gives, like, you really feel like, okay, he's crossing the line way too much. And so,
yeah, like the Brie Larson one.
Oh.
With her face.
Oh, yeah. When you see the end, you realize, no, everyone was having fun. Everyone was into it. They all appreciate the humor. They don't mind themselves being dragged down into the mud.
But based off their responses, I don't think they know what he's going to say.
No, they don't. It looks like they're told, okay, you're supposed to be displeased, and Zach's going to ask you a bunch of questions.
Yeah, that are very off color, because there's a few times where they just seem totally, like I said, the Brie Larson, I don't want to spoil, but she just seemed really cut off guard and laughed hard on what he said.
Well, it was so good. And that's why this has to be a 3-star movie in my eyes, because there is so much laughter and those moments are so well done. It's just hard to properly call it a movie.
Well, it reminds me a few years ago where there was a movie that I also said had a lot of flaws, but you at the end said, I knew you're going to recommend it because you said you laughed, and we laugh so little in comedies nowadays that laughing is an automatic recommendation.
It is, isn't it? It means it's pass. I pass you. I knight you and send you forth into the realm.
Yeah, like, I don't know how much I'm ever going to rewatch this movie or anything, or if it's even going to stick with me, but... It was entertaining in the moment, and I think that's all a movie like this aspires to be.
Indeed. So, yeah, it's worth seeing, especially if you are a Zach Galifianakis fan, then I would say this is mandatory watching.
Yeah, if you like his sense of humor, and if you definitely like the Between Two Ferns skits, I think you'll have a good time with this. So, yeah, that's 3 stars from both of us. Mm-hmm. And now we are going to go to a movie that came out in September when we weren't really reviewing a lot of movies. We had a lot of... theme shows, and so we're now finally going to catch up with Hustlers. This was STX Studios' latest movie, and this is a type of movie that, as I had said on that show, the report card show, that I want to see STX do more of, the stuff that's geared towards adults. And so Hustlers is about a group of strippers, and but it's this one ends up being less, you know, striptease and showgirls and more kind of Goodfellas type thing. Because what we have here is Constance Wu. Her stripper name is Destiny. And this is based off an actual real life event and based off a New York magazine article that came out in 2015. And they kind of start at the beginning where we're learning that a lot of what we're going to see is sort of Constant Wu's, her character Destiny's answer, sort of recalling events. It's her sort of going through the experience of what happens. Because what we have is she's trying to break into the stripping industry. She's trying to just make a living. She's trying to support her grandma. And she's sort of having a hard time standing out. It's really competitive. You've got to give a lot of money to the different bouncers and people and stuff in order to get into the premium rooms. But then she comes across Ramona Vega, who's a longtime stripper played by Jennifer Lopez, and she takes her under her wing. She makes her pro teach. She teaches her how to sort of entice the men and how to do some dance moves. This leads to a really interesting scene where Jennifer Lopez, I guess, did a lot of training to be able to do these moves she does on the pole. And there's no special effects here. Like, she's legit doing it. It's impressive because I think she's in her 50s now and that she can pull off these moves. It's like, this is a definite great physical act. And it's a sexy scene, I won't lie. So basically she's showing off those moves, and she comes, like I said, she becomes her protege, and they're doing really well. They're making money. They have their clientele, and things are going well. And then 2008 happens. If you remember 2008, that's the big housing crisis, which has created a lot of films. I mean, we've got Adam McKay, who's essentially just making movies now based off that 2008 crisis now. And so what happens here is the Wall Street folks, they ruined the economy, and that means it's hard to make a living right now because people aren't going to strip clubs when you're just trying to eat now, when you're just trying to scrape by. And so they've got to come up of a way to make money, to make a living. So a few years later, we jump ahead, they meet up again, and they come up with sort of this scam where you go in and you lure a business type, a rich person, and you get them to come into the club, you get them to drink a lot, you get them basically drunk enough where they're free with the credit card, but sober enough where they can sign the check, is basically how Jennifer Lopez says it. And so they're trying to do that. And then when that's not working as quickly as they want, they start coming up with some drugs to drug the men and get things moving faster. And so they're definitely making crimes here. And what I like about this movie is they are not trying to totally make these women heroes. It's like the Goodfellas thing. We see this idea that initially we connect to them. They're just trying to get by. They're trying to support their kids. They're good peoples. They got screwed over by the evil business type people. But they do make mistakes, and they go down this plunge, and their life is going to start unraveling. They go down this dangerous direction, and the film is making that very aware. But because we care about them, we want them to come around. We want them to make the right decision. We're still rooting for them, even though we know they're making big mistakes. And it's because there's really good job with the characters. I think Constance Wu, I'm hearing a lot of praise for Jennifer Lopez, and this is an amazing performance by Jennifer Lopez. She is a very complicated character, a loyal friend, but also a manipulator. They do a really good balance of her being sort of the mastermind, but someone who actually does care about her group of girls too. And I like that balance. But Constance Wu, who's the star of this, I don't think she's getting enough credit. And she was in Crazy Rich Asian. She's on Fresh Off the Boat. She is a talented woman. She's amazing in here. She has to do a lot of balance too, because she's torn. She eventually has a daughter she has to look after, and she's not really comfortable with what she's doing here, but she's still going in. And I think they do a really good job of balancing that. This movie's got a lot of humor. And the suits, the stockbroker types, they do a lot of silly stuff. They're ashamed of what they've done. You get some humor off that. There's eventually investigation by the cops. They play a bit for laughs. There's a lot of kind of colorful, engaging characters here. And it's kind of by the beats. You know, this type of movie based off a true story, you know, there's a hustle and, you know, the rise and the fall. It follows all that. And so you could kind of call it a predictable movie, but I think it works well because you are engaged in the characters and there seems to be a little bit a level of detail and attention to these characters. It's stylized. It's got an energy to it. It's definitely adult. It's at a strip club, so you're going to see some nudity and stuff. And so, and it's funny, I guess just in this day and age, I mean, that just feels different. You don't see that as much. And so it definitely feels like an adult film. It doesn't feel exploitative, though. It's not like 80s or 70s kind of nudity where it's trying to be super sexualized and sexualizes the girls. Even though they're strippers, I thought they balance it fairly well here and keep them as characters and doesn't degrade them in that way. And so I think that works really well. Julia Stiles is the interviewer here. It's just nice to see her. I think she's a very talented actor, and you don't see her. I don't see her as much anymore, and so I like Julia Stiles here. That she played off well as the interviewer. I love the relationships here. Yeah, I was very invested in this film. And it shows that you can have a film that sort of has the standard beats, but just does things a little bit different and can engage you. This is a delightful surprise. I thought very little of this movie going in, and I was like, wow, this was great. 3.5.
That's wonderful.
I did not think I would be liking Hustlers more than Joker.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think it was even a year and a half ago we were... It truthfully seemed that there was so little of this adult content that was in the theaters and was doing well. And this is its fourth week. It's number four, and it's past 100 million worldwide. And by next weekend, it's probably going to be past 100 million domestically. So I love it. I love that we're starting to see these films that are successes now, especially this one. It's got women as the leads, and it's not all white women. And I love the fact too, because this is an issue in a lot of movies, is you're allowing someone older, an older woman, a older men. Sean Connery, how old and grizzled was he when people were like, he's the sexiest man alive? And women would never get that honor of being gray, graying gracefully and being told that they were the sexiest woman alive. There's such a double standard. So I love the fact that they're, and people obviously don't seem to be complaining. They're giving a room for Jennifer Lopez, who doesn't look her age, but is her age. And that's allowed. That's fine. That's good. I'm so happy that that happens, because it doesn't happen near enough for the women out there. Something I didn't realize, I just noticed now. Did you know Constance Wu was in Sound of My Voice?
I did not.
I had just found that out now. So that would be
point to you, sir.
Thank you. So that probably would have been the earliest I had ever seen her.
I didn't even know she was working at that time.
No, I didn't either. I had no clue. I loved her in Crazy Rich Asians. And yeah, this film I really, really do want to see after what you said. It sounds like, even though you said it's got the beats, it sounds like the angle that it's taking it on is different enough. The fact that it's the women, that sort of thing, that, yeah, it's a movie that I'm really, really intrigued in.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel like a checklist movie. Like, when the movie's done, you realize, okay, it went in the direction that these movies go. But because the characters are believable and everything happens due to actual motivations, and it doesn't just feel like, oh, now we go here. There's scenes that lead properly to each part. Mm-hmm. When Destiny starts having doubts, and when there is the guy where she feels like she shouldn't have done that too. I mean, it felt natural. It felt like they organically set that up and put it in place. Even when they decide to do the hustle, it's not just one day. They build to it. They take their time to get there, so you understand why they've decided to start committing this crime. And because they built it, and because they did such a good job of doing sympathy, you're still rooting for them, even though they're doing bad stuff. So to me, it's just it's got that smart, delicate hand here.
So with Widows last year and this movie this year, do you think women in crime films And with Ocean's 8, do you think that that is something that, you know, audiences are coming around to and being open to?
Yeah, I would say yes. I mean, obviously, Kitchen didn't do very well, and Widows underperformed Sally, but this was a huge hit. So, and I think Ocean's 8 did well, too. So with the right marketing and the right stuff in place, these movies obviously bring out an audience. Like, there's no way around it. This movie is a hit.
Yeah, which is
right
wonderful.
Now, like, that's why I love it, because it's a good movie. We don't get much of these, but it's showing that, like... Now, I think movies like this are geared towards adults. I think there is... This is where I think it's smart that you release it at the right time. And I think September was genius. And I think they had the right star in there. Because I think for adult movies, I think a star helps a bit. Mm-hmm. And so I think they just all the right things in place for this movie to do well. And it deserves it. This is a really good movie. And we've got an obviously very talented director who... just makes this film very, very stylized and have a lot of energy to it. This is the same person who did The Meddler from a few years ago, which we haven't reviewed, but they also did The Seeking Friend for the End of the World, which I remember I liked more than you.
Yes, yeah.
I think you appreciated
a
lot of it.
I did,
you just
yes.
didn't hook as much.
Exactly, yes. But it's impossible to say it wasn't an interesting film.
And that you look at all the things she's done here. I'm looking down the line of what she's been involved either as a writer or as a director, and interesting film seems to be what she does. So I mean, she's definitely someone who wants to sort of, I think it's like mainstream movies, but going in a bit of a different direction. What's really interesting though, she wrote The Hustle, which is very adult. Her next writing credit is Soul, which is a Pixar movie.
Wow, she's a writer of Soul, because that's just next year, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's I like it. That's cool. I love when people can just jump around all over the place. That's great.
She's diverse. And so I appreciate that. And, you know, I really enjoyed this movie. And it's just really cool to see something like this. Because like I said, I mean, they did a good balance of, yeah, it's kind of sexy, and yeah, it's about strippers, but at no point did I think they remained humans all the time. There wasn't that exploitive nature that a movie like this would have come out 20 years ago, and I definitely would say that a female could come watch this movie and feel comfortable all the way through, because it makes the strippers real characters here, and I think they even sometimes put a little bit of a human bent on some of the stockbroker characters. So they're not just like pure evil there too. The guys from Wall Street, not all of them. So I think it balances things really well here. I would definitely recommend my wife to see this, I think. I think it's a good movie for most adults. I think it's a crowd pleaser.
Awesome. Here's a bit of a question. I think I've already sort of asked it, but a little bit different. In the gaming industry, it was so toxic about women in the games, but big games kept pushing forth, you know, female characters, and the fans complained. But in the last year, like an example game I just got recently, Borderlands 3, huge game, four playable characters, one's a male, one's gender neutral, and two are females. And I didn't hear any fans complaining. So
awesome.
While there was all that pushback where people were like, oh, you know, enough of this, you know, pushing females down our throats and all, now it seems to have gotten to a point where it's accepted. That's it. To the point of, like I said, there's more female than male in Borderlands. And I'm noticing now, like, there was all that backlash and pushing back about some of these very female-centric movies. But now it's like we're getting these movies and people aren't saying it anymore. It almost feels to me like we've burst through there, and now it's people aren't even noticing it as much.
I wasn't surrounded by women for this screening. It was a fair amount of guys and girls that went to see this movie. So I would say, yeah, like I don't feel like there's anyone like, oh, well, this is a girl movie. I mean, I did see one critic say something stupid on Twitter, but for the most part, yeah, it seems like people have been pretty accepting of this movie. I should mention, I talked about how like Adam McKay has sort of done a lot of movies based off the 2008 crashed, so I shouldn't be surprised he was producing this film.
That's awesome. That's very cool.
So he was still involved. I was like, yep, that makes sense.
That's awesome. Well, I'm happy that it's performing well. I'm glad that people aren't just, you know, writing stuff saying, oh, it's a female-centric movie, so don't go see it.
The audience seemed pretty diverse. I'm just kind of bummed that it came out in September, because I'm guessing you probably aren't going to get this in before the end of the year.
It's quite probable, yes. That is quite
well, especially
probable.
What they're doing well right now, because I don't think they decide on when it's released on video until it gets out of theater, and I feel like they're not going to pull it if it's still number four after like 5 weeks.
Yeah. So it could be a bit. Yeah, could be.
It's still here in Brantford.
Yeah, I think it's playing in Kinmount, which we're about to enter the last weekend of the Kinmount Theater, and I had planned on seeing The Joker and possibly this, but then a vet bill has limited my movie viewing options for the moment.
Yeah, I've been there, unfortunately. That's if somehow you come across money, you know, because sometimes magical things happen, my advice is you choose this one over Joker.
Well, after today, I think I will.
Good call.
So now from 3.5 to I'm very curious in finding out, we move on to Netflix's Falling in Love. And this is very obviously one of those schlocky romantic comedies that have now become a signature for Netflix. Usually it seems to be around, you know, going fall into Christmas when they're coming out. And I have learned to have an absolute hatred for them. Although I've also learned from the sequel to Christmas Prince is that there can be some fun stuff in there. And if you are an avid listener, you would know I gave the first Christmas Prince a half star and the second one 2 full stars. So I didn't find the sequel irritating. I didn't hate my life. And so it shows that I think that people can do these, and if they know what they're doing and they just have fun with it and they don't take it seriously and just, you know, yeah, throw themselves into the fun. And I'll tell you this right away in Falling in Love, our main character, Gabriella, she's in a boardroom to have a meeting and, you know, in walks Chad and he says something and he's being followed by a bunch of guys. And I had to rewind it because I didn't think I caught it, but he says something and they all go, Chad, at the same time. It's just in the background. And I'm like, holy crap, this movie's going to be amazing. It then got really boring. I have to say, I got really, really bored by this. That moment at the beginning made me think, okay, they're going to throw in these little nuggets through a whole way through the film that are going to keep me entertained and just make me love it. And I felt that maybe while they were wanting to do that, they didn't do it with much vigor or energy, because while it checks all the boxes, I didn't feel this personally like it checked them with style. Our main character, Gabriella, she's working out on a you know, exercise bike with VR because she's very hippie and or very trendy and with it, even though, seriously, VR, I think people need to realize that VR, as cutting edge and the new thing as it was going to be in the 80s, and then again, it's just not there. But Gabby's into it, so all right. Anyways, she has relationship issues with her boyfriend, Diener, and then she just doesn't like life and enters a contest to win an inn in New Zealand. And this is when the movie actually started having some personality, I found, because a lot of times when movies that feel North American made and they go to different locations, you feel like, okay, this is still written by Americans. When they got to New Zealand, I felt like, even though I don't know if it's actual dialogue and you know, phrases they used, it actually felt like, okay, I think there's some authenticity to the dialogue of the people she's interacting with. And I liked that, because like I said, a lot of times it just feels like it's an American's idea of what a foreign country would be like. This one felt like, you know, these people would say it. They're small town New Zealanders. So I have to give it credit. I thought that that aspect was well done. And it seems rare that, you know, that becomes something you really notice in a movie. She has a loathe at first sight with a very handsome person who, for some reason, she has to hide from every time she sees him in public, because their loathe at first sight wasn't like he punched her or anything, or she punched him, but like they're in the nursery together and she has to hide. They don't hate each other that much. They just didn't, you know, get along. Anyways, this movie does check all the boxes. And from my experience at the beginning with Chad, I thought it was going to do it with a certain flair. Because, like I said, you can do things so generic and so cheesy, but you can still have an energy that says we're having fun. I checked the runtime of this film a number of times because I just wasn't entertained by the interactions. I didn't feel like there was much that was really, really pushing me through all these different encounters. So I don't recommend it. The Chad part, that, like, honestly, you're going to have to go back and listen to it when he walks in and just really pay attention. Everybody, like the whole like entourage of four or five people, all say Chad at the same time. It was brilliant. That set my hopes up for something that was going to be really special. I give it a star and a half, and a lot of that's based off of what
Chad,
and also what I thought was authentic sounding dialogue, which I said it seems really rare. And I feel like the leads were trying to do what they could. I just don't feel like there was much actual energy or anything, and I, like I said, I was kind of bored. So did I say my rating? Yeah, star and a half.
Yeah, you gave it a star and a half, and I didn't hear Chad. So I think I was off the boat quicker than you, because I just interpreted that scene as like, oh my goodness, how generic is this? The jerky guys who aren't paying attention to the girl. Mm-hmm. Oh, yep, the meeting got pushed. Like, I just right away was just like, oh my goodness, we are in Trope City. And I just quickly looked at a review, and someone said it owns the tropes, it takes charge of the tropes. And I didn't really feel that.
I just
felt this was pure checklist movie. So like you, I was out of it for the most part, because I'm just like, everything just like, look, she won a hotel. Well, I bet the hotel's going to be dilapidated. Ooh, yeah. What a shock.
Oh, it wasn't as she thought. Yeah. Yeah. I bet you there's a gay couple.
Or even like, I bet there's one other bed and breakfast in town, and she's not going to like her moving in.
Mom, I bet you she and he are going to fall down at some point. And
on top of each other.
Yeah, this one. Okay, if you want to talk about owning the tropes, Set It Up owned the tropes. Set It Up just was unashamed of what it did. And that had energy, and it had vibrant leads, and it didn't mind showing you, okay, yeah, look, we're doing this now. But we're doing it with energy.
Well, you've got to follow the tropes romantic comedies, like a Set It Up or To All the Boys I Loved Before, but they have a certain bar. They had lovable characters. They had really funny moments. They played around with the genre. And so, to me, on the top of the mountain, you've got Set It Up and To All the Boys I Loved Before. And then this one, it's not right at the bottom, but it's quite a ways away from the peak.
It is quite a ways away from the peak. Did you at least appreciate the dialogue, or am I just reaching for stuff here?
No. I got you there. I actually did think that it felt like somebody maybe in this film is from New Zealand, or they seem to have a bit of an idea of the culture there. Yeah, I didn't think it was just sort of yeah, it's one person's vision. Like, I think they actually did the work. Like, it was filmed in New Zealand, so that helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which yeah, goes a long way. And I did like they showed the landscape.
New Zealand location, so that's why it felt authentic. And I bet the dialogue was authentic, because if they're in New Zealand, you actually have people to reference.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's I find it odd that this little film got something right that so many films get wrong.
Yeah, because this is the type of film that you think they would have done an overblown caricature, but they didn't. And so, yeah, no, I give them that. So I'll give them a star and a half for effort. Oh, no, I'll give them a half a star for effort. And so now they get a star and a half.
Well done. But this is okay, I would say if you like are like me and are a media masochist and want to watch something that's going to make you want to pull the skin from your face, this isn't it. Was it Holiday Calendar? Something like that. Christmas Inheritance. Those are the movies I would say. Because this
one
was
more
just
annoying than this.
Yeah, this one was just boring at like absolute boredom at times. Did you know? Okay, honestly, full truth here. I was about 10 minutes into this movie, 15 maybe, and I thought that there was an audio problem with it. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to, because I listen with my headphones. That's how I watch all the movies on my computer. Because I've got decent headphones, which gives a good experience. And I thought, okay, either there's something wrong with the setting on my computer, or the audio is not mixed well in this movie. So I'm like, okay, I'll just quickly, I'll start, you know, playing a few moments of another Netflix film. So I'm like, oh, I'll just watch the intro to Murder Party again. Just, you know, to see our hero pick up the invitation and get so pleasant and his day so pleased. Did you know I watched it till there was 10 minutes left and realized, crap, I have to be watching another movie.
So after we said that we would rewatch that movie, you would.
And then, you know what? The parts that were still great
are great.
They are great. And I've forgotten to mention when he's getting ready for the costume party and he goes into the closet and there's this big box that says Halloween costumes on it, written in Sharpie. And he pulls a costume out, looks at it, tosses it aside, and then grabs the cardboard box.
He had an idea.
Yeah.
He was inspired. He wasn't going to let the fact that he had a costume take him down. He wanted to be a knight.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and so I actually had a question, and I was going to ask it at the beginning, but I didn't want to derail things. And I think we're fine not talking about falling in love anymore. Just because I started thinking, and this falling in love being in New Zealand, I remembered Housebound and What We Do in the Dark, or What We Do in the Shadows as good horror comedies. And we talked about how we get scared about horror comedies. What do you think, just quickly, what makes one work?
I think the big thing is that the comedy comes from the quirky characters and how they respond to situations, rather than trying to do like wacky sight gags or let's reference all these horror movies from the past, because isn't that funny?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would agree. It's got to be in the realm of reality. Because if I look at something like Shaun of the Dead, they're still in the real world. It's just the characters that make it funny.
Yeah, and you care about them, and you want to be with them. And yeah, it's more this idea of slacker stuck in a zombie world. The threat's still real, and I think that's important. Like, even something like Gremlins. Like, the Gremlins are wacky, but they're still dangerous. And I think there still needs to be a threat, or why are you putting in the horror element?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just wanted that question quick, because, you know, I ended up watching Murder Party again.
You know, that's awesome. Yeah, the only other thing I want to say, going back to this movie, then we'll never talk again, because I'm not going to revisit this movie, like Murder Party, definitely not. I think you maybe kind of said it, but like, I think Christina Milian is like a talented person, but I felt the two leads, not only was I kind of dull of the movie, but over time, they both started annoying me.
They did. And I think my thought is, my what I think it comes down to, because I see moments, like with Christina Milian, where I'm like, wow, there's something there. And those moments were mostly at the beginning of the film, because it got so crappy and so steeped in tropes. Because what I ended up feeling like is, number one, it's the material, and number two, I thought that maybe the direction she was giving didn't work with her.
Yeah, I think they're just trying to make them too quirky, and you can go too far to the point where you're just like, I never want to spend any time with this person.
Which was most of the characters in this movie. There was one. There was a gag that I laughed at about someone who'd never had a nickname before, and
yes, was fun.
That made me laugh. I thought, well done. That was actually a fun little thing. But I mean, there's not much else to really hold on to in this film.
And I also do like how excited he was of that nickname. It wasn't that creative.
Yeah, that was good.
So now we're going to talk about something completely different, comic book movies, because that never gets discussed on this show. But yeah, it's interesting because there is definitely this stigma towards superhero movies, even though they are the highest grossing movies right now. They're big, massive hits, but there's definitely a pushback with this idea that, like, Marvel, as good as they are, and some of these other ones, that they've almost sort of littered the landscape of cinema. They've come out here and they've changed how movies are. They've made movies dumber. They've made movies more kind of lower common denominator type thing. They're just more about sort of theme park rides and experiences, and rather than these deep kind of complex films. There's this frustration that superhero movies are degrading stuff. I mean, Ethan Hawke basically said that like a year ago, this idea that he doesn't really want to be involved with them and he doesn't really think they're high-end films. And then we have Martin Scorsese, who is an amazing director, one of my favorite directors, love his films, who essentially said that he can't get into superhero movies. He tried, he didn't like them, and he doesn't really think they're cinema. They're not his vision of what he thinks movies should be. And James Gunn then responded, a lot of people responded, Twitter, like Scott said at the beginning of the show, kind of exploded, and he was frustrated and hurt, partly because Scorsese kind of made it clear that he hadn't even really seen the movies, so he's talking about them degrading cinema without actually seeing these films. And I think James Gunn went a little bit hyperbolic. Like, he was trying to say this idea that, well, remember you made that Temptation of Christ. Scorsese made that Last Temptation of Christ. It was a very controversial movie in the 80s. I remember seeing, like, news articles about it. I remember my church speaking out against it. It was this vile film among religious circles. And he was almost trying to compare that to sort of how some people are viewing comic book movies. And it's not really on page, because, I mean, there was picketing for that movie. There was some violent responses to those films. There was a massive backlash, and I don't really think there's that same idea with superheroes. It's not a perfect comparison here, because I think most people are just saying we don't really like superhero movies. Well, Last Temptation of Christ, there's people who thought it was sacrilege. They thought it was blasphemous. They thought it was evil. They're trying to get it removed from cinemas. And I know Scorsese's not going to petition to get rid of superhero movies. He's just saying he doesn't really like them, and I don't think he likes them being the major film. And so I think there is sometimes this weird hostility that we have. And James Gunn wasn't. Like, James Gunn did, I think, respond well. Like, he also explained his side a bit more, and he was just hurt that he would form an opinion without seeing them and has a view of superhero movies that maybe he wasn't fully informed. And so he did come about it well, but there was a lot of people that came back more violently about the Scorsese thing and were just more hostile. And I do think that's foolish. I mean, opinion is an opinion. People can decide they don't like superhero movies, and it doesn't make them less of a person. Scott's not huge on musicals. I like musicals. There's nothing wrong with that. You have your things you're attached to. And so some people just don't like the direction where big budget films have gone. I actually talked to someone that said he doesn't go to the theater much anymore because they're all superhero movies and he doesn't like them. He's not true. I was able to list him a bunch of movies that aren't superhero movies, but the reality is those just aren't his thing. And there's no reason to attack people about it. So I think that part's silly. One of the things about Scorsese, though, is I do think he is being unfair, especially if he hasn't seen it. Like, I can't tell if he doesn't like a movie, he doesn't like a movie. But I think with him admitting that he hasn't really seen them, he is shortchanging them. They're not just big special effects spectacles. They're not just big dumb films. I mean, you think of James Gunn's film, Guardians of the Galaxy. It's about finding a family through abandonment. Losing your family, losing your place in the world, and how we attach to new people and create a new family. Like, there is some deep issues that both the Guardians of the Galaxy movies explore. Iron Man 3 looks at, like, depression and handles how you deal with almost like post-traumatic stress disorder and those type of things. Like, there's some interesting ideas, and Black Panther, very complex. With their villain and this idea of diaspora and where do we call home and where's that sense of belonging? It deals with race. And I can list so many of the Marvel movies that are really deep and complex and have great dramatic elements and tackle stuff. And I've given several of the Marvel movies 4 stars. And it's not just because they blew up things real good. It's because there's an actual depth to these films, better than a lot of the Oscar bait stuff. The things that I think Scorsese may be supporting, I think Marvel's done some of those better. I know there's film critics that are very opposed to these Marvel movies, and I think sometimes maybe they don't go in an open mind. I think a lot of them are really good. My next point, which I think is really sort of lands things here, is Cisco. Like, I do think superhero movies obviously are the temperature of the time, and they are dictating sort of what studios are green lighting, and so it does unfortunately push away maybe some other films. I mean, we still get a Hustle, we still get that, but I want to talk about Gene Siskel, because Gene Siskel was talking about how the big budget films have they've become the focus, and that he feels that movies now are more geared towards like teenagers and kids, and they've taken away sort of things that are for adults, and there's been a dumbing down of cinema. Oh, I forgot to mention, Gene Siskel passed away in 1999. So these things that we're saying, that we're talking like, oh, this is how things are now. Gene Siskel was talking about these things back in the 90s. Then you go back 20 years before that. I was watching old Roger and Ebert stuff. He was talking about the dumbing down, making things more for teenagers. In 1981, he was saying that they were making things that the blockbuster stuff was taking over. 81, he's saying that. You look at the slate of 81, and you're like, what? So this is a thing that had just, it's always bothered people. Where when Star Wars came out, everyone just thought, oh, things have changed, and we're not making smart films anymore. And then smart films came out after that. Great movies came out after Star Wars. And I think great movies are going to come out after the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They will continue. It's not the end. What you have to do is you have to seek them out. You have to actually be open-minded and look. Like I said, there's a Hustlers right there at the theater in Brantford. There is things for adults that are still there. You just have to look for it. Big blockbusters being dumb and pandering to sort of having more kiddie fare. Like I said, it's something that Siskel has been was complaining about in the early 80s. So I just, that part I laugh, is that, so people who are upset about superheroes things, like, you just, whatever's big is going to be what they complain about.
Yeah, it's I think I can see people getting upset. I can see, you know, someone like Scorsese, I could probably, if I think and try to put myself in his shoes, I'm not surprised that he might say that sort of thing. Like,
I think he had to do a lot of work to get Irishman funded. So I wonder if that's partly where it comes from, is his latest movie was not an easy greenlit, despite the fact his name is Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is that I, like James Gunn said, he felt saddened. And that's what I feel too, because, you know, I don't like, or my line is, I don't like musicals, I don't like Victorian movies, and I don't like horse movies. However, there have been many movies of each of those over the last number of years while we've done the podcast that I've liked.
That made your best of the year list.
Yes, last year The Rider was way up there. The Favorite was that was an era that I don't normally get into. Musicals, Into the Woods, and because I honestly think that we can't write anything off. We can't, because otherwise we're not giving people a chance to speak. And please, if Martin Scorsese, if you're listening, I'm not saying you're not right or entitled to your opinion, or that you're wrong. I'm just saying that I think it's I'm saddened by it because I think everyone needs to be heard or should be heard. And you know, we can find gems in genres that we think there should be nothing into. Just the high school slice of life drama or story that, you know, the kids will just, you know, smoke joints to and watch Dazed and Confused. You know, people may have heard even just the title and thought, well, that's just a stupid teenage movie. But when you watch it, there's something wonderfully complex in there. And yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I just wish that there wasn't this right off of everything. I think it's fine to say that I'm not into something normally, but I do believe it's important to still give those movies a chance. I still think that it's important to say that something could be told, that, you know what, and you know, way back, talking about Transformers, I remember you on the podcast boldly said that you believe Michael Bay was an auteur because of the commitment and dedication he puts into the visuals. And while the movies may be lacking, there needs to be something respected about those films because there is something that is a crafted work of art. And so I don't believe we should write anything off completely because of the genre it is.
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing. When James Gunn was saying he was sad, I think he was largely sad because Scorsese was writing off movies that he openly said he's not even watching. He was calling them the bane to cinema. That's not the exact quote he used, but he basically said that he didn't consider them cinema, but he also admitted he hadn't seen most of them. And so part of the issue of the backlash towards superhero movies, and you go back, probably the backlash towards science fiction movies in the 80s and action films of the 80s, the problem is most of these people who are just talking about, like, oh, I don't like superhero movies, they probably haven't even seen most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're forming an opinion on these movies without seeing them. And so it's almost better just to say, like, well, I don't watch them because I don't think they would appeal to me. But trying to write something off, especially trying to say it's not cinema, I think is... this is a part where I say it is unfair. I don't think you should pass judgment on things you haven't seen, because it reminds me of these Twitter people who jump on something and be like, oh, this is wrong, this is offensive. And it's like, but have you even seen it? Like, you know, like, let's wait until we've seen the material before we call it evil.
Yeah. Which actually just happened with the Joker. Parents of survivors and victims of the Dark Knight Rises theater shooting wrote to Warner Brothers and basically ripped them a new one for releasing Joker because it glorified gun violence.
And again, you're right.
Like, and they hadn't seen it.
You need to watch the movie first before you make that criticism. I would say it does not glorify gun violence. But I mean, I definitely think it's a more complicated film than some of the other stuff. But yeah, it's just unfortunate that we seem to be so quick on hating something or tearing something apart before we've even seen it. And I'm glad you mentioned the Michael Bay thing, because I do believe Michael Bay is talented. I think he's skilled. I just haven't liked most of his movies. And I say most because I haven't seen them all. So I don't want to assume. He has another movie coming up soon starring Ryan Reynolds. It's going to be on Netflix. I'm not going to go in thinking, oh boy, it's Michael Bay. I might like it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. If I didn't watch Christmas Prince Christmas Prince 2, I may have thought that one would have been getting a half star as well. There was one response that is very pointed, but I have to read it. Okay, so I'll read first the entire quote that Scorsese said, because that's kind of important. Scorsese said, "I don't see them. I tried, you know, but that's not cinema. Honestly, the closest I can think of them, as well made as they are, with actors doing the best they can under the circumstances, is theme parks. It isn't cinema of human beings trying to convey emotional, psychological experiences to another human being." So John Hinckman, who I guess in the comic book world is a big name. He's a writer on X-Men, the X-Men comics. He tweeted, I haven't tried them. I don't eat them. I tried, you know, but that's not actual dining. Honestly, the closest I can think of them, as well-made as they are, with chicken doing the best it can under the circumstances, are spicy hot wings. This isn't fine dining. It's just burning your effing mouth because you love to see the world's mouths burn, and I won't have it. I won't have any effing part of it.
Yeah, that's a good response.
Which I could understand someone like him, in the comic book world, and I think that, you know, it can be said that comics themselves shouldn't be written off because they do try to deal with things. They do deal with coming of age. They do deal with being an outsider. They do deal with identity. And so I can see someone who's in that world seeing the Scorsese comment and being hurt by it.
Well, I mean, I collected comic books, but I was definitely aware. I collected them when I was in high school. I collected them right before high school. So I collected them way back before these big movies were being made. And I knew people were passing them off as kiddie stuff. They're passing them off as silly stuff. And with me knowing full well that these people did not collect them and read them and not know that, no, there's complex stuff here. It deals with depression. It deals with adolescence. It deals with coping with the real world while, you know, being colorful, big action sequences. Like, I already knew that was things that comic books do. I knew that they were deeper than a lot of stuff that people thought was more higher end. And I knew it dealt with better stuff better than some of novels that people thought that I should be spending my time with. And so I'm used to that. And yeah, the issue is some things aren't for you. You're not liking it. But you should only form your opinion on the things you've actually kind of seen before you write it off. You can say, I didn't like this, but I've only seen this movie. I don't like musicals because they sing through problems. This is the movie I saw. But to then like cast all every movie after that as, oh, I find this annoying without seeing it, I just think it's ill-informed.
Yeah, I do. And I think the closest thing in my life is I know a lot of people that just horror movies are for teenagers and horror movies are vile things that are just pointless and all about blood splatter. And
that's coming from someone that clearly does not watch a lot of horror movies.
That is correct. Yeah.
Cause that's not accurate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's definitely, I mean, cause yeah, people write off things that they haven't seen a lot and it is unfortunate. And I think, like I said, my line is I hate horse movies, hate Victorian films and musicals, but I'm still gonna watch them because I still there's bunches that I still like.
Yeah.
And it's important to not just cut them all out because you think that you're gonna hate them all. But
yeah, no, with the horror thing, you definitely nailed it. I've had people who, you know, I respect and I like, and they've asked me before, like, what is it you like in horror movies? Ugh, you watch horror movies? You like horror movies? And often I'm just like, so which ones have you seen? And usually they can't really come up with much. So I'm just like, I mean, if you don't want to see it, yeah, fine, don't ever see it. But just, it's funny when they dismiss it and think I'm watching this nasty piece of cinema. I'm like, you might actually like Get Out more than you think.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Shall we run down the movies we talked about this week? One of them being a pointless theme park comic book movie.
And I didn't do much to take care of that problem.
The first movie we talked about this week was Joker. This was directed by Todd Phillips and starring Joaquin Phoenix. And we like the movies with the harder storylines, but Chris didn't really find much to this to really sink into. I like the performance of Joaquin Phoenix, but this just it felt like episodic, you said, correct?
Yeah, I felt it was just a bunch of scenes to kind of shock rather than a film that was cohesive, like a Nightcrawler or a Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm. And Chris gave that 2 stars. Then it's off to Between Two Ferns, the movie. Zach Galifianakis interviewing people, which, if you're a Zach Galifianakis fan, you need to see. It's a good comedy if you're just looking for some laughs. But both Chris and I agreed, as a proper movie, it's... but we both recommend it because it did make us laugh a lot. So 3 stars from each of us. Then Hustlers. This was a film starring Constance Wu and Jennifer Lopez with Julia Stiles in it. Women in sort of more of a Goodfellas feel of a film. Chris gives this one 3.5 stars, and I really want to see it. And then it's off to Falling In, and that's in with I-N-N. So it's a joke, Falling In Love. And if you think that joke is hilarious, then you probably still won't think the movie's hilarious. it's a bit of a just dredging through it. It very boring. There's some things that were okay, but both Chris and I gave it 1.5 stars. So if you're paying attention to us, check out Between Two Ferns on Netflix, or go to the theater and see Hustlers, because they don't make movies like that anymore.
Yeah, no, Hustlers is worth it. Yeah, those movies just do not exist.
You can't find them anywhere. They don't make movies like that anymore.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But go to the theater and see how they don't make them.
Exactly. Then you can email us at themoviebreakdown@gmail.com, and you can hit us up on Twitter at moviebreakdown1, and our Facebook page, The Movie Breakdown, as well. iTunes, if you listen to us through your Apple products or you have iTunes on your PC, then subscribe to us. And... you know, write a review, give us a rating. It's all fun. And if you haven't heard our podcast, don't write us off.
That's right.
Yes, but you wouldn't.
So I don't know how you're here.
Hearing this, yes. So, anyways, I will have soon up a review of Daddy Daycare, which was a punishment movie from losing the cinema, the box office challenge from the summer. I will have that up on moviedayblog.blogspot.ca, and as well, my Instagram is a movie worth 1,000 words.
And you can read my writings over at chrisspicer.blogspot.com. And I said it last week, hopefully this week I actually get it in place. I would also am hoping to move our podcast over to Stitcher and Spotify and a few of those other places, if that's where you prefer to listen to your stuff, so that we grow and expand there. And I've got a bunch of stuff planned on the blog too. So there'll be lots of stuff for you to enjoy in that area. And then come back here and enjoy some more movie reviews as we're continuing the movie talk, the movie reviews. We've got a coming-of-age tale that's been on Netflix called Tall Girl. It's about a girl who's really tall and how she doesn't fit in at school. And as well, we've got the latest Stephen King adaptation. It's based off... it was the joint novella between Stephen King and his son, Owen King. Together, they made this novella called In the Tall Grass. And I've read a lot of Stephen King stuff. Most of the movies we've seen, I've usually read the works. This is actually one I have not read yet.
Ah, so this is something you've got no, you know, you're going in completely clean on this one.
Yeah, other than I kind of know the synopsis, but yeah, I don't know the story. So this won't be one of the cases where I compare to, oh, how is it to his other works? Unless I decide to try to catch it, read it at some point this week. I don't know how big of a novella it is. I don't know if I can get it in before I see the movie. So I'll probably just see the movie. I feel like Stephen King, I mean, It Part 2 is a bit disappointing for me. But on the Netflix area, I think largely his stuff's been home runs in the last few years.
Like we had Gerald's Game, we had 1922. They were both fun to watch.
Yeah, I don't know if there's I thought there was another one, but maybe that's just ones I know are still coming.
Hmm. Yeah, so there's reason to be excited about it.
Yeah, so we're kicking off our first sort of horror movie for October in The Tall Grass. So that'll be enjoyable, and Patrick Wilson is in that one. And so I'm really interested in that. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting week next week. Also next week, for those who like this, we're going to have our bi-monthly, our every few month Scott review roundup.
Yeah, because I've now seen movies that I hadn't seen before. So if you're looking forward to my thoughts on something like John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum, you'll be able to find that out next week.
Yeah, because you'll have to get my thoughts on the theater movies, but Scott, you have to wait a bit, but that'll be next week. We finally get his rebuttal to my films.
That's right. We get to hear why Chris is wrong about why John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum is the bestest John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum ever.
I was going to say, I didn't say it was the best John Wick movie, but you corrected yourself.
Indeed. So please join us next week. It's going to be fun. Until then, I am Scott Martin.
And until then, and now, I'm Christopher Spicer.
The past, the present, the future, the man himself, Christopher.
Forever and always.
Chad.